You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Kerri Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, if the state is providing medical benefits to you, should you have to work to get them? States like Indiana, Arkansas, and Kentucky think so. They've got waivers from the federal government, and they plan to initiate work requirements quickly into their Medicaid programs. Some lawmakers in Minnesota think it's a good idea, too. The bill being debated at the Capitol would require that some Medicaid recipients be permitted to keep their benefits only if they work, look for work, do some kind of community service, or are in training for a job. By the way, 60% of Minnesota's Medicaid recipients have worked at some point. We have two guests joining us, but I think the view of you, the voters, and the taxpayers is really important in this debate, too. Should state-funded medical benefits come with a requirement of a job or job training or community service? Do you think overall government assistance makes people less inclined to work and provide for themselves? So talk to me about that this morning. Here's the number as you think about it, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at KerriNPR. Our guests will join us in a moment. We're beginning with NPR's Brian Baxt, who covers the state capitol. Brian, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Hey, great to have you back at 11.
We should note, Brian, that many state lawmakers, Republicans and DFLers, are looking at the cost of Minnesota's Medicaid program, and they're worried about how fast it's accelerating and how much it's costing. $5 billion, is that right?
It's one of the biggest drivers of the state budget, and even though the federal government does absorb a lot of the cost overall for the program, the state is putting in more and more.
You have a sense about why the costs are rising so quickly?
Just healthcare in general. I mean, if you look at private healthcare, health insurance is costing more, so it's cost more to deliver these services. And, you know, some of these people are sicker. You know, that's one of the reasons they're on these programs and unable to work is because they are quite sick, and so they absorb many more costs than say the average person who goes to a 9-to-5 job.
So Brian, I mentioned that other states are doing this. Is the bill that is being debated right now modeled on what Indiana and Kentucky have done? What's informing the discussion there at the Capitol?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, this is kind of a two-step deal. Minnesota could pass a law, but they need to get permission from the federal government. Much like those other states, they had to go and apply for waivers from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And the Minnesota bill would say that the state has to go by October 1st and ask for this waiver. And if the state didn't go to ask for the waiver, the Department of Human Services would be penalized by having part of its allotment allocation withheld by the state. And so if they got the approval, this would kick in around January 2020.
Okay. So as you understand what the bill says, are the work requirements aimed primarily at people who don't have children? Is that where the debate is focused on at the state capitol?
That's right. There's quite a few exemptions in this proposal for parents and caretakers of minors, for people who are pregnant or people who are older, 60 years or older. They would get some exemptions from this. People who are working some now, a minimum of 30 hours per week or you know what the equivalent of that, they would be exempted from this. So there are some outs here. They're looking at people who don't have minors in the household who they think could be eligible to work. They don't have a medical or a mental condition that would prohibit them from holding down a regular job.
We should say that I think that adds up to about a couple hundred thousand of Minnesota's Medicaid recipients. So what's the big deal? I mean, that's not that large of a percentage of the people who are getting these Medicaid benefits. Why the big debate?
Because the people on the other side of this debate say that there's a lot of factors that put people in these positions, that they can't find work that they're qualified to do that pays them enough to afford health care, or they have some sort of disability that could potentially keep them from steady employment, or that they have some issues with finding appropriate care or transportation to a job site. So that it's not just about whether they could work, it's whether they could find work that could allow them to live the same type of life with the benefits that they're getting now.
Okay, so this is a good point. This is the quality of life issue too, right? It isn't just what kind of money are we spending on this and what are people doing with it? There's an expectation of a quality of life. I imagine that's being argued on the other side of this. Go ahead.
That's right. And there's also an argument about the mechanics of this. I mean, this would require every month for the Department of Human Services to certify that people are complying with this. And if not, they would have their benefits suspended. So it would create kind of an additional layer of going through to check everyone and making sure that all the forms and everything is in place. So it's not as easy as just people voluntarily giving it up. Someone would have to go and say, you no longer qualify for these benefits. And there's a lot of churn in this population.
Right.
And people come on and off jobs. They come on and off the Medicaid program.
NPR's Brian Baxter is with us. If you've just tuned in, he covers the state capitol, and we're asking him for the political perspective on this conversation we're having about attaching a work requirement to some receiving of Medicaid benefits. This is a debate that's going on at the state capitol. Other states have done this, and Brian's giving us a sense of what the arguments are on either side. I understand Governor Dayton doesn't like this, Brian, and he's already talked about vetoing, but there are ways around that, aren't there?
Well, that's right. And he didn't come to that position immediately. When this was laid out, he kind of left an open door to it, saying he wanted to hear more. But then he firmed up his opposition to it. But I want to mention that this thing has some powerful forces behind it. House Speaker Kurt Dowd is one of the co-sponsors of this. So you can expect that this is going to get to Governor Dayton's desk in some fashion. And it could be in a bigger budget bill that has items in it that the governor really wants. So they might ask him to stomach this to get other things. And so this is coming his way, most likely. It's just a matter of whether he can hold up his opposition through the end.
Okay, so this is important to say, because we are about, what are we, 4 weeks, 5 weeks from the end of the session? And
42 days.
42 days, but who's counting? But, I mean, what happens here is you end up getting a lot of these large, important bills where there's a lot of special interests, right, committed to seeing that these bills pass. And the governor might want some key things that he wants to accomplish in this legislative session. And this issue could end up as a mix in one of those larger bills. And so he might be loath to veto that bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's right. And just this morning, he issued a letter to top lawmakers basically saying, please don't put any extraneous policy measures in these budget bills. We've heard that from Governor Dayton before, and lawmakers really didn't heed that. They did it anyway and made him pick and choose. So he's trying to head off some of these choices that he doesn't want to have to make in order to get additional money for opioid prevention or K-12 education, early child education. They might leave him with that choice.
Brian, always good to get you the benefit of your reporting and your experience over there. Thanks much. Good to have you here.
You're welcome.
NPR's Brian Baxter with us, who covers the state capitol. To remind you here, if you're just getting in on the conversation, we're talking about whether, if the state of Minnesota is providing medical benefits to you, should you have to go to work to get them? Now, as I mentioned, states like Indiana, Arkansas, Kentucky think so. They've gotten waivers from the federal government, and they plan to initiate work requirements into their Medicaid programs. This is a debate going on at the Minnesota State Capitol, and we've asked two guests to join us to talk about this. But as taxpayers and voters, I think it's really important to hear your voice on this, too. So, should state-funded medical benefits come with a requirement of a job or job training or some kind of community service? And do you think overall, we're going to talk about the philosophy behind this, do you think overall that government assistance makes people less inclined to work or to provide for themselves? So talk to me about the specifics of this legislation, but also the big picture here, the philosophy of that. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. And I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR, where Chris says, yes, I believe there should be work requirements to get government assistance. If the person is able-bodied, by all means, there is a lot of community service that can and should be done. You can reach me on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Our guest today, Tara O'Neill Hayes, is Deputy Director of Healthcare Policy at the American Action Forum and with us today from Washington. Tara, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
And Dr. Nathan Chomilo is a pediatrician and vice president of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity. He's based here in Minnesota, but we also find him in D.C. today in the same studio with Tara. So, Nathan, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Carrie. So happy to be here.
Minnesota taxpayers, Dr. Chomilo, are spending close to $5 billion annually on Medicaid benefits. What is your sense about why the costs are rising so quickly, which is, I think, leading to these kinds of debates in state capitals? What's going on with these benefits?
You know, like Brian explained, I think, pretty well, that the patients that we are seeing are getting sicker. And a lot of the times, if we don't have coverage for preventive care or basic care, we show up sicker. And, you know, that's a difficult question to tack down exactly where the costs are coming from. I do think that this legislation doesn't really do anything to address costs at all. If you look at it, what it's doing is it's putting barriers in front of people who are eligible for it. And these the works of signing, having someone track if you're able to work or not is going to cause counties to have to increase the number of staff. It might have to even increase property taxes to cover the staff just to track this.
So, Tara, I asked about that, why the costs of providing these benefits is going up, because there seems to be a thinking behind some of this legislation that we're throwing away money, in essence. We're giving benefits and money to people who don't necessarily need it. Is that part of the argument for something like this?
You know, I would argue anyone who is looking at these requirements as a mechanism to save money and really use this as a budget cost control measure is looking at this the wrong way. Nathan is correct. This is not going to save substantial amounts of money, most likely, to the effect that it does save money because someone who is currently enrolled in the program is deemed ineligible because they're not meeting these requirements. You know, at most across the country, I think we're talking about roughly 1 million people based on the required exemptions, you know, the populations who are required to be exempt, mm-hmm. as well as the subgroups of people that states are choosing voluntarily also to exempt from the program. And so I think if anyone's goal is to do this strictly to save money, they're going to fail, and they're not doing it for the right reasons.
Okay. Let me take some calls here. We have a number of Minnesota voters and taxpayers who want to weigh in on this. To Nathan in Minneapolis. Hey, Nathan. Hi. How are you thinking about this?
Hi. I'm all for a work permit, like requiring work to be a part of this, but some things that from my personal experience that were a struggle was when I got a job, I was penalized severely for still being on state-run care, mm-hmm. for not getting off of it fast enough. And that was before my benefits for my new job took over. And then potentially there being a wait period. I mean, some of us go through jobs and there's time slots in between jobs. And that's just a fact of life.
So, Nathan, it sounds like you have some experience with needing medical benefits for a certain amount of time. And you're saying when you ended up with your next job, you ended up being penalized on those benefits before the medical benefits kicked in from the new job. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And you're saying what about an easement in so you're not penalizing people that are in this kind of transition point?
Some type of like time expectation, not just instantly, oh, you have a job, you need to be off this program, but
okay,
hey, you're in a job, here's 4 months or whatever, like the process could, they need to figure out what the insurance companies normally kick in for their employers. but it's more of a transition into that new job that I can continually have benefits the whole time, even if I don't need to utilize them the whole time.
Sure.
I have had some hefty emergency bills due to lapses of health insurance in the past and put me in poverty for a while.
Let me, Nathan, let me take this back to our guests here. Dr. Chomolo, that sounds pretty practical. Would you be in favor of something like that?
Well, I think what we know from the evidence and what I cited in the op-ed I wrote that was published in the Pioneer Press last week is that the more barriers we place to patients getting benefits that they're eligible for, the less likely that our fellow Minnesotans will get the benefits that they need to stay healthy, to stay in the workforce. And so, you know, the situation that Nathan is describing is just one of many variations, as you can imagine, that if you are required to submit that you are working or not working every month, that you are likely to fall off. I mean, I myself am a well-supported guy, and I just turned in my tax papers. I can't imagine having to certify that I have to work every month, and these are the number of hours I worked. What if I'm working two or three jobs? I have to get that information from multiple employers while I'm figuring out how to get the transportation or get the internet access, you know, or the time away from work to do this. And so the more barriers we put in place, the less likely people are going to get the care they need to stay healthy and in the workforce.
So, Tara, Dr. Chomolo is hitting on a couple of different things here, which is just this requirement to certify is time-consuming and burdensome. And the idea that you're really drawing time away from people that could be out there working or looking for work or doing training. Is that a fair complaint about this?
It absolutely is. And I think the caller as well, you know, both of these individuals have pointed to particular problems that could arise through the imposition of these work requirements and the, you know, paperwork burden that comes along with that. And so I think it speaks to a number of issues that need to be understood and dealt with from the state level. I think it's important that any state, and in fact, they're required when they submit their waiver to CMS, that they include strategies on how they will ease the burden, what they will do to help beneficiaries, you know, understand that these requirements are there, what they have to do in order to meet the compliance requirements, et cetera. And so, you know, I would say I think that it is important that any state that imposes these requirements takes the time and dedicates the appropriate amount of resources to actually ensure that these individuals are able to meet the requirements and that they don't lose benefits simply because of the paperwork burden.
Because of that certification piece of that. Okay. Right. To the phones here to Doug in Moose Lake. Hi, Doug. How are you thinking about this?
Well, I guess you could say I'm kind of on the fence about it, and kind of here's where I stand.
Mm-hmm.
I get that we need to have some sort of requirement on people that you shouldn't be allowed to collect any type of benefits from the state if you're not able to work, because so many people are taking advantage of it. I get that. I've seen that. I know of somebody that gets complete Social Security at the age of 18 because he grew up in the system. But yet I, who am a veteran, have a hard time getting dental care, and for the last 2 years have had to go without dental aid when I have abscess teeth that need to actually get removed and just finally was able to finally get it. So it's a pretty biased system, and in all honesty, I think if we could get rid of the special interest groups and the crooked politicians for all this stuff and just tell people, look, if you need this, we'll give it to you, but if you're able to work and we can prove it, then you got to do it.
Okay, so Tara, what do you? Doug was right when he said I'm on the fence on this because he's kind of arguing both sides. What do you hear in that?
Sure, I would push back a little and say, you know, of course, everybody knows someone who is inappropriately receiving government benefits, and it irks them to no end, right? But I do think that. Story is a little overblown. I don't think that the fraud in the system is near as prevalent as some would have you believe. But to the extent that it is, to the extent that people are abusing the program, you know, they are taking resources away, which are very finite and limited, from the people who do need those benefits most. And so to the extent that any requirement does weed out people who are inappropriately benefiting, I think those measures are necessary and appropriate. And so I would say to the extent that that happens, it's okay. But I also don't think it's as common as people tend to think that it is.
Yeah. Dr. Chomolo, advocates for the bill say it really isn't unreasonable to expect that some people who can work should work. And I guess I would ask, I mean, what's been the barrier to the people who, again, are able to work, maybe have more of kind of a spotty work history? I mean, what's the barrier when you're getting these benefits to actually putting more effort into finding work? What's the evidence tell you about that?
Well, I mean, I think the barriers are many. We talk about social determinants of health that exist in these patients who are struggling with poverty. So it's stable housing, it's transportation, it's safety, it's education or literacy. You know, are they functionally literate to know to get the resources or where to find jobs, where to find training? And so these are all things that our patients and the people and families I take care of are dealing with on a everyday basis. And, you know, this legislation doesn't address any of that. It doesn't give any assistance to job training. It doesn't do anything to promote that. And I'll just add this quick
here. Sure.
There's no, you know, medical diagnosis for able-bodied. This is a political term. It's not a medical term. And so you're going to have people who are, you know, struggling with mental health. They're struggling with injury or other illness. And, you know, they don't have to figure out how to navigate a system to find a doctor or a county worker that's going to certify that they are able-bodied or not without any clear guidance.
You've actually hit on something that I want to come back to, and that's the mental health side of this, because I think we need to explore that as well. Let me go to Phil in Minneapolis. Hi, Phil. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm healthy. I've worked all my life and proud taxpayer. I saw my late sister pass away as a quadriplegic, and I strongly oppose the Republican efforts here. I'm very skeptical of what the Republicans are trying to do here in the legislature, especially at the time they're trying to cut transit, you know, and that includes outstate transit as well. So, you know, if this legislation should move forward, there's got to be protections for the disabled. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. And let me go to Abby in St. Louis Park. Hi, Abby. Thank you for waiting and good to have your call. What are you thinking?
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah, you know, I was just, I think I'm in line with the other guy, you know, the couple calls before. I think if the system, you know, it's not, sometimes when you look at it, it's not fair to the middle people. The people that are receiving Medicaid, and I would argue, you know, we have to require people who are receiving something from the system to work,
mm-hmm.
not only because they receive only Medicaid, but anybody who receives any assistance, like housing, food stamps, transportation assistance, anything that the government provides. If you can work, you have to work, because there's a lot of people, you know, that your guest was saying, you know, the people who abuse the system is just a little bit, but it's not.
Yeah, you know, Abby, actually, you've actually raised some good points that I wanted to bring back to Tara and Dr. Chomolo. Tara, I mean, is this a somewhat slippery slope of, as Abby is saying, first it's Medicaid, now it's if you're able to live, if you're getting some kind of government benefit for your housing or job training or any kind of government benefit. Is that where we're headed? And does the underlying, you know, argument around this, the philosophy of that, support that?
Well, you know, again, I think we need to understand that it's a small subset of people who would be held to these requirements. And we do have work requirements already imposed in other government assistance programs, namely SNAP, which is the food stamp program, and TANF, which, you know, in TANF, when those work requirements were put in place, that was under President Bill Clinton. And the evidence showed that when we put those work requirements in place, unemployment rates dropped, and particularly for single mothers. Sorry, I'm trying to find my note here.
Okay.
The labor force participation for single mothers increased from 66% in 1993 to 79% in 2000. And the poverty rate for those individuals fell to 33%, which was an all-time low. And the child poverty rate of those mothers fell from 22.7% to 16.2% over that same period.
Although I'm going to counter that, Tara, with some studies, including one out of the University of Pennsylvania, that finds that a majority of people who are able to work and receiving government programs use the money for more education or seeking a higher paying job. It's not money that's kind of disappearing into a black hole. It's being put to use for better job prospects or for better, you know, quality of living. How does that fit with what you've been citing?
Well, you know, I think that's great, actually. I mean, the point of these programs, you know, I said at the beginning in my remarks that, you know, this should not be viewed as a budget money saving effort. This really is about promoting self-sufficiency. And so to the extent that individuals get a job and eventually are able to move themselves off of Medicaid and other government assistance, you know, they move themselves out of poverty and no longer will depend on these safety net programs. Yeah. One of the only ways to move out of poverty, probably the only sure way to move out of poverty, is to have a job.
Ella says, I'm sorry, Dr. Tremolo, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, I would just, you know, counter that what evidence also shows us is when we put these barriers like the work requirements in, there's unintended effects of people that are eligible for this medical care to better themselves and their children and families lose access to it.
And why?
There's probably a lot of things going on there, but, you know, children in particular live in families. And so a lot of our families who are living in poverty or dealing with poverty, it's not just the parents who are helping take care of them. It might be the grandparents. It might be aunts, uncles, neighbors. And so if people are, and those people are sick, they're unable to work, damages the whole ecosystem that we are trying to raise our families in. And so I really do think this is about the dignity of Minnesotans, and we want and we should value every Minnesotan, and we're all just one job loss or accident or catastrophic illness away from needing Medicaid. And this legislation is something that will damage Medicaid.
Dr. Nathan Tremolo is one of our guests today. He's a pediatrician and vice president of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity. And Tara O'Neill Hayes is deputy director of healthcare policy at American Action Forum. We asked them to sit in today and have a conversation with us about a bill that's being debated at the Minnesota State Capitol. It looks a lot like bills that have passed and are being implemented in states like Indiana and Arkansas and Kentucky, a work requirement that goes along with Medicaid benefits for some recipients of those benefits. I'm asking you about the details of that, but also about the overall philosophy of that. And some of this is informed by the idea that overall, government assistance makes people less inclined to work or provide for themselves. That's a belief in some parts of our political arena, and that guides some of the thinking on this. And I wonder where you come down on that and what you think overall of the idea here. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Jake says on Twitter, I enroll eligible individuals in Medicaid. The end of the month is always a stressful time as people wait for counties to process their verifications. They panic because they don't know if in 3 days they can access their insulin, make it to their appointment, etc. Tara, given some of what you've already said in the discussion, I would think that that's something that concerns you about the way these benefits are allocated and just the process of them.
It absolutely does. Again, you know, I think that it's very important that the state really understand all of the burdens that are going to be imposed on an individual. They need to make sure that there are resources available, people available to tell these individuals what they must do to comply, you know, help them work through the paperwork and ease that burden as much as possible. That being said, just because something is hard or will be difficult to implement and do right and do well does not automatically mean that it should not be done. You know, the government imposes regulations on businesses, on working individuals all the time. You know, regulations sometimes are necessary, though they are burdensome. And so there's always that difficulty in striking the right balance there. Also, states are required to provide, you know, describe in their waiver how they will provide assistance to beneficiaries in meeting those work and community engagement requirements. They are required to link people with resources that the state already has in place, whether it's job training programs, childcare assistance, transportation, et cetera. And then they also are required to consider local economic conditions. If, say, a rural area has extremely high unemployment and an individual simply cannot get jobs, modifications or exemptions need to be provided for that.
Yeah.
If public transportation is not available, states have to consider that as well. And so I actually applaud CMS to the extent that they did outline the various obstacles that individuals might face and require states to recognize that and provide modifications or even exemptions in those instances.
So there's a community service piece of that, and I want to take a call on this and then go to you, Dr. Chamilo, to find out what you think of it, to Chris in St. Paul. Hey, Chris, you wanted to talk about the community service piece of this?
I did. Thank you for taking my call. My thought is kind of, instead of putting all the emphasis on the work side of it, put more emphasis in the community service and provide opportunities for some of these people to give back. So there's a balance give and take between what the state's giving them and what they're giving back. And especially like we just mentioned about lack of jobs, there's always community service opportunities. And there's always different places where something can be given by the people that are receiving these benefits.
So, Dr. Chamilo, what do you think of that argument?
Well, this legislation doesn't do anything to, get those community service opportunities in front of people. Doesn't add any additional funding or support.
As in,
those
where
measures.
Would you, how would you find these opportunities, those
them?
Kinds of things? Okay.
And then, you know, and certainly counties and our legislators can make all these exceptions. But what I hear is just more and more red tape that our hardworking families have to jump through. And, you know, really a lot of the patients and families in the clinic I work in, about half of my families are in Medicaid. And they're among the hardest working Minnesotans I know. They often both parents are working. They do split shifts. So mom gets the morning, dad gets the evening. Mm-hmm. They do that so that they can do childcare and not have to spend extra money for childcare. And we're, you know, just adding more hoops for them to jump through without any, there's no evidence that this legislation is going to accomplish any of the things that people are concerned about. It's not, that it's actually going to make people work.
Dr. Chamilo, do you believe that this is particularly aimed at, or maybe I should put it this way, that it will fall disproportionately on people with mental illness who, as I said in the introduction, might have a spotty work history, but who are perceived from the outside looking in as, well, why aren't they working full time? Are those the people that may end up, losing benefits or caught up in this?
They're absolutely among the groups that are going to be at highest risk if this goes through. A lot of people struggling with mental illness are also in poverty because of their struggle with mental illness, with lack of stable conditions to help them get on their feet. Or if they do, they have a mental health crisis and can find themselves starting back at zero. This legislation is really putting the onus on some of our neediest Minnesotans. And really, we don't require this for other parts of, what you could consider a government handout, tax breaks to corporations. We passed reinsurance legislation last year for health insurance companies, and we didn't require them to even guarantee us that they would decrease the premiums. So we don't put any of these hoops in front of the people who have power and who have voice, but we put that through the people who have the least amount of time to be sitting down at the Capitol Hill pleading their case.
Miko says on Twitter, work requirements may be fine to receive some government aid, but not for health care. Basic health care should be a right, as it is in all other wealthy countries, to Nikki in Sturgeon Lake. So, Nikki, you've heard the conversation develop here. What are you thinking?
I'm against this. I think that the doctor is right. When someone has a health issue or are sick, I don't think the regular person understands how overwhelming that already is.
Mm-hmm.
And also then what happens when they lose the coverage? Where are they going to get the help they need? Is the hospital going to provide it free of charge, or are they going to end up bankrupt?
Good. Yeah, Nikki, you're raising good questions here. I will put them to Tara O'Neill Hayes. Tara, that's been raised in the debate here. You take benefits away and people end up in the ER, and that is some of the most expensive health care that you can get.
Sure, absolutely. And I would say, you know, that speaks to other problems in our healthcare system. And it's one that we have been plagued with for decades, if not forever. And so I think there are a number of things that need to be done across the healthcare system and, you know, with reforms and whatnot to increase access to people, to make health insurance more affordable. But I would argue that's kind of a separate issue.
A call here from Ellen in Lake City, Minnesota. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also kind of mixed about it. I'm okay with there being some type of requirement, but I think that requirement shouldn't necessarily be work. I think it should be to work with the person to understand what's preventing them from having the kind of life that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe empowering, you know, some of the workforce centers to do more training, to provide more options for people. Because from a social standpoint, I don't think there's anybody out there who wants to be on any kind of benefit.
Ellen, I think you told one of our producers that you're a parole officer, and so that experience informs how you're thinking about this. Is that right?
Right. So many people come out of prison or come out of situations where they've had some issues and they lack the confidence to believe that anyone wants to hire them, much less that they're capable of doing a really good job at working. So I would like to see more effort on getting people to the place where they are able to work and taking the focus off what they're receiving in the meantime.
Okay. I appreciate the call and your thinking on this, given your work in the correction systems. To Nelson in St. James. Hi, good morning.
Hi, morning.
What are you thinking of this?
Okay. My perspective on this is that the programs are not actually designed to help people become self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
From my perspective, over the years of being on benefits through the government programs, your benefits are disproportionately reduced or you're just cut off for every extra dollar or benefit you gain from working, making you need the programs even more. I tried really hard to work myself off of the programs, and if you make a little bit of money, they take away twice as much of your benefits, or they just cut you off.
This is,
so there's no gradual reduction to help you work your way off of the program.
Yeah, we heard this from another listener, Nelson, and let me bring this back to Tara and Dr. Chomilo. Dr. Chomilo, do you think there could be, I don't know if you're happy with just the way the programs are structured today. I mean, we're hearing people say what we really need to do is get into these programs and make them more accessible, I guess, for people who are transitioning back to work. And that means changes within the programs themselves. Do you agree that that's necessary?
So, I mean, healthcare in general is very messy right now, and Medicaid is no exception. I think one of the proposals that the legislature has in front of it is the Governor Dayton's buy-in to Minnesota Care as a way to give people that thing to reach for if you're able to make enough money, to get off of Medicaid. But once you're off, then you can't find insurance that is affordable, and your employer doesn't offer any insurance. Minnesota Care buy-in makes a lot of sense to me, and that's something that the Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity has been advocates for.
Got it.
And I just wanted to touch briefly on this kind of idea that the program overall doesn't get people off of Medicaid.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we really look from the start, the people that benefit the most are the children who grow up on Medicaid and families on Medicaid. You know, we have great evidence that children on Medicaid have fewer school days missed, which leads to better performance in school. Then they end up getting better jobs. They live healthier and they pay more in taxes. And so this is, you know, really a way to lift whole generations out of poverty, not just one person at a time. And I think, you know, damages and cuts to this program are potentially going to damage us in the long run as well.
So, Tara, what about the idea that this is not the way to improve these programs themselves, having heard what two listeners who have actually received these benefits are saying about, you know, trying to transition back to work? Is that where the focus and the debate ought to be?
There absolutely is concerns there with how these programs phase people out of assistance, and that oftentimes there actually is no phase out at all, as you know the last caller just spoke to, that your benefits just immediately are cut off. And that is a real problem, and I think it is something that does need to be dealt with to the extent that we could provide a more gradual transition. I think a lot of people would really benefit from that. At the same time, you know, the flip side to the argument is how gradual should that phase out be? At what point should the cutoff actually come in? Because eventually there's always going to be a cutoff. There's always going to be a point where you become ineligible. And so it's a subjective decision to make as to what that point should be. I think there's difficulty in finding that balance, but I think it's fair to say that we are not yet at the appropriate balance.
This is a conversation, by the way, if you've just gotten into it, you can find it on my podcast. So you're listening to the discussion, but we're, you know, almost at the end of it. Really good voices here from our listeners and our guests. And if you want to find it, just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts, and you can hear the whole hour-long conversation. We're talking about whether state-funded medical benefits should come with a requirement of job or job training or some kind of community service. It's a bill that's being debated at the state legislature. Other states like Indiana and Kentucky have put this into effect, and we're hearing voices on both sides and good arguments on this. To Julie in Crystal. Hi, Julie. How are you thinking about it?
There's just a couple points. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The first one is they had a similar program during the recession for the family with young children. And that basically became, they used to call them job cops. And that was very punitive in nature. And many of the people that were in that program were penalized if they did not find a certain number of jobs per a certain period.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many young women, with young children, they'd lose those benefits. They'd have to reapply, go through that again. And, you know, so I look at this as another punitive program.
Okay.
And I'm a public health nurse, and I see people all the time for waiver services. I see people all the time, and we talk about employment. We talk about vocational training. They can't do it because they either have mental health issues, substance abuse issues, physical, medical issues. And so many are certified disabled, and they are eligible for it.
Right.
They're eligible for that program, and they're eligible because of their income level.
Yeah, Julie, actually, you've raised a question that I want to come back to Tara and Dr. Chomolo on. Tara, I mean, do we have evidence that says, yes, they've tried this in, I don't know, other countries and other states, and we can see that we're getting more people to work and we're saving the system money?
You know, I'm not aware, actually, of evidence in other countries, but I will say that the federal government is requiring any state that imposes these work requirements to do a substantial or substantive evaluation after so many years of the program. Now, I do have concerns with making sure that those evaluations are, you know, thorough, that they're evaluating the right things. And, you know, doing program evaluation is very important, but also very difficult. But to the extent that those evaluations are successful, you know, states will have to show that health outcomes are improving, and that people are not simply losing coverage because of an inability to comply and then ending up uninsured. You know, they have to show all of these things that show that the requirements are effective at meeting their goals and that people are benefiting from it in order to extend this waiver and continue the program going forward.
So,
and
Dr. Trumla, go ahead.
Yeah, I would counter. There is some evidence recently released by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities that the short-lived benefits that Tara described with TANF and SNAP or food stamps, those benefits are short-lived as far as getting people out of poverty, that overall work requirements really don't achieve that in that population. And I would focus on what Julie was talking about, is the people that are going to suffer from this legislation aren't the people who aren't working. It's the people who are working and have to go through these extra hoops that are going to struggle to maintain their coverage and keep their patients or their children and their families healthy. I see parents who are coming in late in the evening because that's the only time they can get off of work, that I have to write letters all the time for employers explaining that a child is sick at home just so they can keep their job. And so these are people that are working hard. And the idea that you have to morally reform the poor by declaring them able-bodied or not able-bodied is just all a political one. Again, there's no diagnosis for able-bodied. There's no way, clear way to determine poor, able-bodied workers versus not.
Yeah, Tara, I have to say, when Dr. Trumla says that this is political, it is indeed political, right? It is a philosophy about government and what it should provide and shouldn't provide. We can accept that there are different political views on this, yes?
Yes, absolutely. You can't say that it's not at all political. But I do think that the goals get misconstrued. And again, my very first comments were, if legislators are seeking this option in order to save money, they're doing it for the wrong reasons. To the extent that they are going to help individuals.
Because it doesn't save money. Is that what you're saying?
It's not going to save that much money because there's not that many people who would be disenrolled, who would be found ineligible because, like we've already said, 60% of the individuals who are non-elderly, non-disabled adults are already working, and that's great. And so the individuals who are non-elderly, not disabled, not working, it's a small population. But that's not to say, maybe we shouldn't be asking them to contribute to society, to do their fair share, and whether it's work or volunteering, community engagement, or it could also be they are attending school or a job training program in order to better educate themselves and become more prepared to and be able to get a job and become self-sufficient and not need these programs.
I want to take
But Carrie, the legislators, when they introduced this legislation in Minnesota, they stood there and they said it was to get people out of poverty. We've discussed, and it seems that people seem to generally agree that this doesn't really help get people out of poverty. We've discussed, and the other thing is we want to reduce costs, is what they said, the reason that they're introducing this legislation. Everyone in this room agrees that if that's your reason to do it, that's not the way. So, the reasons for that legislation
being... Although I have to say, I think Tara's been pretty candid about, again, if you're looking to save money, no matter what they're saying on the floor of the House or Senate, Tara is saying today in our conversation, this is not the way to save money.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's backed up. There was an op-ed in the Star Trib today that said that it's actually probably going to cost money, particularly from our counties, which gets down to the taxpayers. And so now we're having taxpayers pay for them to basically kick people off of Medicaid who deserve it.
This is not about kicking people off. To the extent that we encourage those who are not currently working to go and get a job and become self-sufficient and enable themselves to not depend on these programs, if you think longer term, eventually they should A, not need these programs, not need the benefits that they're currently receiving, and B, become tax-paying citizens in the country and contribute to the needs of others.
I want to make sure we hear the voice of Lisa here. As we close the conversation in St. Paul. Lisa, forgive me, I've got about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Okay, I'll try to make it fast.
Okay.
I receive Medicaid benefits, just Medicaid. So if there's someone out there receiving only Medicaid benefits and managing to survive without working, I want to know their secret, because Medicaid doesn't pay for housing, food, clothing, phone, electricity, and so on and so forth. And frankly, I don't want to jump through the bureaucratic hoops every month because somebody is paranoid that people won't work if they have help with medical care.
Lisa, I sense the way you describe this, you are working and receiving Medicaid benefits. Is that right?
I'm at work right now on a break, and yes, I received Medicaid. I didn't even apply for it. I was just given it an extension. I had Minnesota Care, and with the Obamacare, I was just put on it, which is great. But, I mean, I don't understand why people think that someone who's just on Medicaid could actually survive out there without working. I mean, it doesn't pay my rent or any of the other bills. So,
Lisa, really good to have your voice in the conversation. Glad you could call in during your break at work. Nathan, Tara, thank you. Thanks very much for the discussion.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
And again, if you got in on the end of this conversation and you want to listen to the whole hour, you can do that on the podcast, NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.